Okay, so thank you very much for coming out this evening. I said when I came into the room, and there were a few people here already, that I was concerned that I'd be here alone this evening. But you made it through the snow, so I give you credit for that. And also, if you sign in, you will get credit for that as well. This is indeed accredited for 1.5 professionalism credits. But you do need to sign in. Please, please don't rely on emailing me afterwards saying, you know, I was there. I can't work from that. Also, signing in gets you a part on the email list that I use to send out notification about further classes, follow-up on this class. If people could please silence their cell phones, that will be helpful. And as always, nothing that I say here should be taken as legal advice. I am not a lawyer, and even if I were, or maybe especially if I were, I would add again, it's not legal advice. But also, it is not halachic guidance for any practical cases. Please, if you have a halachic question, please make sure to ask the rabbi to whom you ask halachic questions in general. You see at the top of the sheet the agenda. Our topic is avoiding sharp practice. So when I file for credit, I always am, you know, required to list which topics are covered in the presentation. So you see it here. Duty to act in good faith and avoid sharp practice, and bulleted below it some of the issues that I expect to address within that. And then also dealing effectively with unrepresented persons, that's going to be part of our conversation as well. And I gave you three vignettes at the start in number two. Vignette number one, and I'm going to ask you what you think after we read it, so start thinking. In August 2007, Lisa, an 86-year-old widow, signed an agreement of purchase and sale to sell her home to Jonathan. Anyone know this case? This is an actual case. I just changed the names. Okay, so she signed an agreement of purchase and sale to sell her home to Jonathan. Subsequently, Lisa's lawyer contended she had signed the agreement under duress and while lacking capacity. And in fact, the background on the case was that Jonathan came to her door with a purchase and sale agreement and wanted to know if she wanted to sell. There were meetings and so on, but that's the way this whole thing started. So the claim is that it was under duress, she lacked capacity. Jonathan filed an affidavit stating there had been no duress. Lisa had been alert, knowledgeable, and willing. In September 2007, Jonathan's lawyer commenced an action claiming specific performance and a declaration that the sale agreement was binding. Later in September, a certificate of pending litigation was served on Lisa. In October 2007, Lisa's lawyer requested an adjournment, in part because he planned to provide medical evidence regarding Lisa's state, specifically to prove lack of capacity, and to cross-examine Jonathan regarding his affidavit. The adjournment was granted for a date to be set. Nothing further was done. Time goes by. In March 2008, without a demand for a defense, sorry, without any warnings, what I should have written, or any correspondence, Jonathan's lawyer noted Lisa in default. The default was only noted in a letter of September 2008, 6 months later, which included an offer to settle. Is noting default without communication an act of sharp practice? She was there. She had a lawyer. Had the ability to, you know, do what should have been done, didn't do so. Is failure to actually notify a case of sharp practice? For anyone who just came in, the source sheets and the sign-in sheets are over there. What would you say? Yes. Explain.
It's just common practice if you need to operate under a waiver, or if you return something signed by, that you're not going to know somebody in default or ask for
defense
once you
send
the letter
for them to acknowledge. Okay, is that generally what people think?
Yes.
Okay. It happens to be true. But we're going to have to go a little further with it in terms of defining why it is sharp practice and what exactly constitutes sharp practice. But yes, I mean, as we're going to see, this is considered an act of sharp practice. One thing we'll also have to see is what are the consequences of labeling this sharp practice. But that's the first question. Second question. James sued XLF Pharmaceuticals and lost. He is representing himself in an appeal. Mary, lead counsel for XLF, sees that James is having difficulty meeting the filing deadline for his factum, but he doesn't seem to be aware that he can request an extension. Is Mary expected to inform James of this option? I see a no. Yeah? A courtesy, but you're not required by the rules or by law to do so? Anyone think that it's more than that? What will be the reason to argue that it should be more than that? Yeah? You might be heading off a problem now by taking care of it, by notifying them now, given that judges in general are going to try to help, in this case, the self-represented litigant. So there's more to say about that. We're going to obviously come back to this case. Let's take a look at the third one. Returning to the case of Lisa and Jonathan, the sale of the house. Jonathan's lawyer believes that Jonathan is right, but she feels that he lacks the supporting evidence to successfully persuade the court. Okay, Jonathan's lawyer feels that, in fact, Lisa had full capacity. Whatever she bases it on, what magic of knowledge she has, doesn't matter for our purposes. She thinks that Lisa actually had full capacity and is just trying to get out of the sale now because she thinks she can get a better deal somewhere else. But she thinks Jonathan doesn't have the evidence he needs. Would that justify sharp practice in failure to communicate before noting Lisa in default? Would the feeling of my client is right justify erring on the side of sharp practice?
The other part of it is that she feels he doesn't have the evidence to prove his case.
Correct.
It aggravates the sharp practice.
It makes it worse.
Yeah.
Because now there's no case and you're relying only on the sharp practice in order to triumph. Yeah? Right. I didn't want to get into the nuances of what happens as a result of this when you're dealing with a case where it's alleged there's lack of capacity. But yes, there could well be a litigation guardian appointed to deal with things from Lisa's side. I just played it as though Lisa has a lawyer and it's normal. I'm not getting into Section 7. Thank you. But yes, there's more to be said about that as well. So these are our three cases. These are the three issues that we want to look at. And we have to begin by discussing the expectations of a lawyer. What is it that the rules are looking for from a lawyer in relation to sharp practice? And there are two separate statements in the Law Society of Ontario's Rules of Professional Conduct which relate to this. I brought them on your sheet. Take a look at source number 3, please. These are numbered based on the 2014 edition. So what you see in source number 3 comes under the heading of relationship to the administration of justice, the lawyer as advocate. When acting as an advocate, a lawyer shall represent the client resolutely and honorably within the limits of the law, while treating the tribunal with candor, fairness, courtesy, and respect. When acting as an advocate, a lawyer shall not deliberately refrain from informing the tribunal of any binding authority that the lawyer considers to be directly on point and that has not been mentioned by an opponent. So there is a duty for the lawyer to treat the tribunal with candor, and as an example of that, to mention all binding authority even if the opponent did not mention it, and even if it's going to be to the lawyer's own detriment. There's an emphasis placed not only on making sure that you're managing the law and making sure that you're arguing on behalf of your client, but that you treat the court, as is written here, with candor, fairness, courtesy, and respect. That's number one. That's not directly invoked in terms of sharp practice. Sharp practice is going to be the next source. But it's the issue of professionalism that is reflected here. The source number four gives you a separate rule under relationship to the law society and other lawyers, responsibility to lawyers and others. A lawyer shall be courteous, civil, and act in good faith with all persons with whom the lawyer has dealings in the course of his or her practice. A lawyer shall avoid sharp practice and shall not take advantage of or act without fair warning upon slips, irregularities, or mistakes on the part of other legal practitioners not going to the merits or involving the sacrifice of a client's rights. So there we actually specify sharp practice. And we say specifically not to take advantage of mistakes made by other lawyers if they don't involve the merits of the case. And if by doing that, by not taking advantage, you aren't going to sacrifice the rights of the client. Is this like a workable definition? What the law is saying here, not to take advantage of the mistakes of others, is the one that comes up most often. We'll talk about who exactly is included within the realm of others and what exactly constitutes a mistake. Those terms need defining. But that's the basics of what we're talking about. The issue mentioned about courtesy, respect, is an important issue in its own right in terms of civility. But if you flip the page onto source number five, I gave you a link to a class that we had back in May of 2017 when we talked about personal and professional misconduct. And some of you I know were there and may remember we had the Snyder case from the U.S., the letter to the court when he was very angry about how they handled his claim for remuneration when he had represented an indigent client. Some of you were here. But in any case, I felt enough people had been there in May 2017 that I wasn't going to bring that into this session. But leaving aside then the civility issue, the other parts of this, sharp practice and the relationship with other lawyers, the relationship with the court, why are these actually a concern? Why are these factors, other than be a nice guy, or if you don't do this, it may come back to bite you, why are these important? I brought you a piece in number six, which I saw, which I like, from John J. Flynn, Professional Ethics and the Lawyer's Duty to Self. And he says, the lawyer's usual response to accusations of amorality rests on the nature of the adversary process in which he is engaged. Neither advocate in a dispute can assume the truth of his position. Truth emerges from a clash of opposing views. So I'm going to say what I'm going to say, and you're going to say what you're going to say, and I'm going to take advantage of whatever I can, and you're going to take advantage of whatever you can, and may the best advocate win. That's what Flynn says people say when told, you know, what you're doing is amoral. What's the other side? Why is it that we have rules that speak to this issue of sharp practice? Yeah? Right. So there's a two-word phrase used in Hebrew regarding desecration of God's name. It's called Chilul Hashem, and essentially that's what we're talking about regarding the law. The idea that you desecrate the name of the law when you act in a certain way. If you jump to number eight, Felix S. Cohn is an American lawyer who had a good way to express the public perception of lawyers. Note that this was 1950. How the edifice of justice can be supported by the efforts of liars at the bar and ex-liars on the bench is one of the paradoxes of legal logic which the man in the street has never solved. Clearly, he's expressing a cynical view. But his cynical view that he's expressing represents what the man on the street may well have absorbed somewhere along the lines. I still remember, it's now, I don't know, 8 years, 9 years since I started giving these classes. And the first one that I did was on a Sunday morning in a synagogue after services. And at the end of services, they made an announcement and they said there's going to be a class on legal ethics. down the hall. And of course, you had the predictable laughs that came out of the room, and the various cynical comments about legal ethics. For those who don't know me, my wife is a lawyer. And I am not, you know, I am not expressing this in a personal way, but the concern indeed is that when you conduct yourself in a certain way, such as taking advantage of technical errors that don't go to the merits of the case, then you propagate this image of lawyers as people who are not concerned really with truth, are not necessarily concerned with fairness, as much as any advantage I can get in order to be able to win the case. If you take a look at source number 9, it supports this as well. The beginning of the rules of professional conduct has a set of definitions. And one item they define is conduct unbecoming a barrister or solicitor. Means conduct, including conduct in a lawyer's personal or private capacity, that tends to bring discredit upon the legal profession, including, for example, committing a criminal act that reflects adversely on the lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer, taking improper advantage of the youth, inexperience, lack of education, unsophistication, ill health, or unbusinesslike habits of another, or engaging in conduct involving dishonesty or conduct which undermines the administration of justice. So it is considered conduct unbecoming for a lawyer to take advantage of inexperience, lack of education, unsophistication, and that becomes the premise, or one of the premises, for rules about sharp practice. But I saw some other hands, and indeed there are other points involved. It's not only about the reputation of the profession. What else is this about? Yes, Gwendolyn.
From a litigation standpoint, if you engage in sharp practice, you're going to polarize the fight, and so when you want to settle or when you need to settle,
right. From a practical perspective, you don't make friends by doing this, and you may say, well, I don't need to make friends, that's not the job of the lawyer in the court, but in certain ways it is, because you are going to need to, and not necessarily in every case, but in many cases, you may well need to work towards some kind of settlement, or if not a settlement, there will be other items that are going to require agreement between the two sides. And so, just from a pragmatic perspective, you don't want to alienate the other side by making them look bad, or by actually taking advantage of what was a simple slip, or worse, could be an embarrassing slip that's just going to antagonize. So on a practical level, that's true. Yes.
It's not just that. You have to be able to trust the lawyer on the other side. Not be able to assume that they're good for their work.
Right.
So there has to be like a reasonably trusting professional relationship between lawyers and sharp practices.
Right. But that's also fundamentally a practical concern. At least the way I'm hearing it.
It is a practical concern.
Right. General trust and trust in the specific case. Is that what I'm hearing?
Well, if the lawyers don't treat each other professionally, it's disastrous for the clients and it makes litigation really extremely expensive.
Right. All true. There's still something else going on, though. Something that isn't as down-to-earth practical, but is nonetheless fundamental. Bill.
Pursuit of truth.
So, pursuit of justice. In other words, if I am going to take advantage of what really was a technical error not going to the merits, then we're not pursuing justice at this point. What we're pursuing is simply winning, more or less. So, that's certainly a consideration. Let me frame it a little bit differently, although I think still on the same page. In source number 7, I gave reference to the 5 duties of the lawyer. I took them from this legal research guide to ethics, but you can find them in many places. There's a duty to the state, there's a duty to the courts, there's a duty to the client, there's a duty to fellow lawyers, and then there are also third parties. So, the duty to the courts, the duty to fellow lawyers, is not expressed in terms of practical results as much as a conception of what a legal system ought to look like. How you set up courts, how you set up representation, how you make sure that justice will be executed on behalf of the community. And there is an expectation that pursuit of justice includes a system in which you aren't simply loyal to your client and to yourself, but you're also going to be loyal to a higher set of ideals. And I think that's a very important element here. There's also another issue which we're going to come back to later, which is access to justice. When you deal with the case of a self-represented litigant on the other side, and the question of, if you're going to take advantage of stuff that the self-represented litigant just didn't learn by Googling it, then you are potentially diminishing their access to justice. Yeah?
I was going to say, the thing is that the challenge in many cases, yes, there are lawyers out there committing sharp practice. The challenge is that in some instances, process is substance, right? That yes, there are the ideals of justice and fairness and merit cases, but at some point, if time goes on, people don't take the actions or steps they're supposed to, ultimately process does become substance, and there's a line that a lawyer has to draw between, well, am I being sharp or am I actually acting in an appropriate way? And as for a person who's either self-representing or represented by a lawyer who's a poor, poor advocate, what typically, in my experience, happens is judges bend over backwards to facilitate things, to make things fair, but sometimes to the point where, again, process, his interference in the process substantively creates prejudice to the other side.
Right. So that's a very big issue in general when dealing with the self-represented party on the other side. We had a class on it a couple of years ago on the self-represented party, and indeed one of the big challenges is that there is an expectation that the judge is going to provide a level of assistance, but there is a concern that the judge bends over backwards and potentially intimidates your client into thinking that it's balanced against them. That's number one. And then number two, the other thing you have to worry about is, while I'm being a nice guy, the fellow on the other side comes to a misimpression that I'm helping them. I may be guilty of sharp practice by accident because they think that I'm going to tell them when something is wrong or when there's information they need. And in fact, I have no duty to do so.
You know, I just had one other thing, which is that sometimes also lawyers have to think about whether they're sacrificing their clients' interests for the sake of preserving relationships with their colleagues on the bar, right? Because they know they're going to have another file with this lawyer or that lawyer.
Right.
The question is, are they actually doing their best job as an advocate, or are they sacrificing that for the sake of, because they know they've got three other files with the lawyer on the other side?
Good. And that's why I brought sources 10 and 11, so that was perfect. Source number 10, an article, Ethical Issues Relating to Lawyers and Unrepresented Litigants in the Civil Justice System. So the writer says, presently I have been a chair of a committee of the American College of Trial Lawyers, which has drafted a code of conduct for trial lawyers in trials involving unrepresented litigants. So he's working in the U.S. He himself is Canadian, but he's working in the U.S. on coming up with a code of conduct for such trials. And he says, apart from the duty to the court and its professional regulating body, the lawyer's only duty is to the client. The lawyer is prohibited from creating any conflict of interest between that duty and a duty to others. In other words, first and foremost, granted that there's a duty to the court and a duty to the professional regulating body, but after that, the lawyer's got to be looking at the client's interests, and if you're going to be worried about every step of the way, this might be sharp practice, this might be sharp practice, what do I have to do for this fellow on the other side? What happens to your own client? And so I brought in number 11, the rule which we already noted, but then the commentary on it from the Law Society's Rules of Professional Conduct. We already said, when acting as an advocate, lawyers should represent the client resolutely and honorably. Look at the commentary. In adversarial proceedings, the lawyer has a duty to the client to raise fearlessly every issue, advance every argument, and ask every question, however distasteful, that the lawyer thinks will help the client's case, and to endeavor to obtain for the client the benefit of every remedy and defense authorized by law. So whatever we're saying about sharp practice should not diminish the commitment to taking care of the client, which is why you end up with some very fuzzy lines in terms of what exactly constitutes sharp practice, what is it that we have to avoid, versus where we say, no, that's actually not a concern and should be ignored. You have a duty to your client, you have a contractual obligation, if nothing else. So we're going to talk about how you define sharp practice with actual cases. But now, I want to flip to the other side of this, which is, what are the Jewish expectations of a lawyer? How does Judaism relate to this issue of sharp practice? So the truth is that there are many parallels between the systems, but I want to start out with something which is not parallel between the systems, something that Judaism throws in, which I think is important to recognize. And that is, from a standpoint of the Torah, of Judaism, litigation is a religious pursuit. Meaning, pursuit of justice is an opportunity to connect to God and to build up the world in the image that God has designed for it. And what I mean by that is perhaps best illustrated in source number 12, a passage from the Talmud, in which, and I brought you the original Hebrew just for authenticity and for those who can read it, but I'm going to stick to English in the interest of time, so I'm going to read out my translations. Ravin, son of Rav Ada, quoted Rabbi Yitzchak, "How do we know that when three judges sit in judgment, God is with them?" And he goes on to quote a biblical verse to support that idea. In other words, whenever a court convenes, even though they're handling a purely civil matter, God is considered to be present. God has to be there in order to oversee and sanctify that which is going on. Best illustration of this, classically, the Jewish high court, the Sanhedrin, convened in what space? Where did they meet? In the Beis HaMikdash, in the temple. Lishkas HaGazis was the name of the room, but the room was actually in the temple complex, so much so that actually half of it was inside the temple and half of it was outside. Anybody know why? Why half in and half out? No, not because of Kohanim. Because you want the judges to be able to sit, but no one's allowed to sit inside the temple except kings. So the way that the room was arranged was that the judges sat in the part that was right outside the temple, but the witnesses, the litigants, are actually in the part that's inside of the temple itself. It highlights the religious character of it, which is one reason why, when you look at Tanakh, when you look at Scripture, you find that the prophets perpetually speak about the importance of proper justice as a religious value, alongside their warnings about not worshiping idols. Because the two go hand in hand. This is considered to be a way of upholding God's world. And I gave you a couple other examples. If you look at source number 13, passage in the Talmud states, "A judge who judges truthfully, even for a moment, is viewed by Scripture as a partner of God in creation." You're creating the world. Or another passage, number 14, also from the Talmud, "A judge who judges truthfully causes the Shekhinah, God's presence, to be manifest in Israel," and quotes a biblical verse to that effect. The Torah describes the presentation of the Torah at Sinai in the 20th chapter of the book of Shemot, the book of Exodus. What is found in chapter 21 immediately afterwards? What does chapter 21 do? Sorry? Mishpatim, right. It begins, and this is civil law. So it goes straight from Ten Commandments, God speaking to humanity at Mount Sinai, right into, and here is civil law. And the commentators note that juxtaposition and say, because that's the point. Civil law ranks at that level of significance within Judaism. It's not our topic right now, but I'll note that this is why this is one reason why there's such a priority placed on litigating civil cases in a Jewish court. Meaning Jewish law wants Jewish litigants to go to a religious court even if they're dealing with a matter that's purely civil. There are a few reasons for it, but one of the reasons that's given for it is because this is a religious act. And to take it out of the religious framework and put it into a secular one raises questions, because then you're deconsecrating what had been a religious act. But that's its own discussion. My point in bringing this is to say that if this is indeed a religious pursuit, the pursuit of justice, for somebody to say, I'm going to win not on the merits, not based on justice, but instead because I was sharper than the other guy and I caught him in a mistake, is to desecrate what had been a religious pursuit. You're taking what should have been holy and treating it in an unholy way. Right? It would be like somebody who said, I don't know, they need matzah for Passover, so they're going to go steal it from somebody and use stolen matzah. Like that's the wrong way to go about it. And that's one element. Second element is parallel to what you see in the secular system, which is that Jewish law recognizes in all business dealings, including what's going on here in the court, I'm framing that as another version of business dealings, a prohibition against any sort of deception and any attempt to make the other party, even in an adversarial proceeding, commit a mistake. In other words, it doesn't matter that that this is adversarial. I'm still not allowed to instigate a mistake by the other party. So I brought you Maimonides making this statement in source number 15. In context, he's talking about a business dealing. And he says, one who interacts with anyone, Jew or idolater, doesn't make a difference. And you know he has to say that because there will be people who will ask. So he says so. Measuring or weighing dishonestly violates a prohibition and is obligated to refund the money. And he says you're not allowed to trick anyone, Jew or non-Jew, in accounting. One must be precise. And he quotes you a biblical verse. It is abhorrent before God to do these things, to perform any corrupt act in any form. So in addition to the statement that law is a religious act, there's a specific prohibition against doing anything which will lead to somebody else's error. Now, sharp practice isn't always that which leads to somebody's error. It's also where somebody's made a mistake, you know, an unforced error. They made the mistake on their own. But I bring it to highlight the importance of being upfront and above board. In addition to that, we have the concern that was mentioned before about public trust in the legal system. If you take a look at source number 16, there's a passage in the Talmud which unfortunately becomes very relevant from time to time in the headlines, talking about what happens if somebody who had been responsible for the administration of law in Jewish courts is found either technically guilty, like through a legal proceeding, or simply there's a scandal develops such that the person is known to have done things that were wrong. So the Talmud states, Rav Huna said, in the city of Usha, they enacted the following. Usha was where the high court moved after the Romans had already encroached upon the temple in Jerusalem. So they moved out to the city of Usha. In Usha, they enacted that if a chief justice goes bad, we don't excommunicate him. We tell him, be honored and remain at home. You know, we're gonna let you keep your dignity. Just stay away from the court. If he repeats the act, we excommunicate him because of desecration of God's name. There's a concern that, like we said, there's a concern within the secular legal system that if you conduct yourself with sharp practice, you cheapen the reputation of the legal system. That's what you're seeing here within Jewish law. I'm not talking about where he's committed a wrong, where you have witnesses and you can try him. I'm talking about where there's some kind of aura of something's wrong, but you don't have the recourse to a court for it to take it further. Bill.
I'm very surprised that the Talmud takes it this far, not because of a religious point of view, but personalizing it by I went to Beijing. I would want to say everything in alignment with what I think God would want me to say, and in fairness. And that might mean saying, oh, well, no, you're wrong about that. I'm actually disadvantaged by this point or this issue, and you have to admit it. That doesn't seem consistent with standing up in front of a judge and being an advocate in an adversarial system where you actually have to tell him every fact, even the ones that don't serve your purpose, and every argument, even the ones that don't serve your purpose, So that justice is served. I don't see that consistent with an adversarial system.
Right.
So that's why I'm surprised. And maybe I'm just,
The catch is that there are inconsistencies between the way the Jewish system works and the secular court system. Specifically, in a Jewish system, it's not set up as adversarial to begin with, and you don't have an official lawyer position classically in Jewish courts. Meaning, you always had people who helped litigants to arrange their case. The term in modern Hebrew for a lawyer is Orech Din. And that's already found in the time of the Mishnah 2,000 years ago, when the Mishnah says to the judges, Al Pas Atzmacha Ke'orchei HaDayanim. You shouldn't act like those who are helping the litigants to arrange their positions. In other words, the judge should not engage in arguing on behalf of either side. But there was no formal position within the courts of a lawyer. And generally, the way that it's described as proceeding was the parties would show up, their witnesses would show up. It's a tribunal of judges who interrogate the witnesses for either side, and the sides can make their arguments of what they what they want, but without a lawyer position who would then be required to make the statement of this will help this one and this will help that one, and the parties themselves are not required to argue on behalf of the other side. So that's true. It's not the same system. I'm using certain parallels because I think they're there, but in the bigger picture, it isn't quite the same. Yes.
So the Gemara says that if the Chief Justice goes bad, they don't excommunicate him immediately. They tell him basically retire and stay at home. So they don't excommunicate him until he repeats the act, which means he doesn't listen, he goes back, and he judges more cases, but only if he repeats the act. Because if he repeats the act, not if he goes back to base.
No, repeating the act means he repeats the transgression.
Right, so he has to go back to base then to be the of base, and then he judges over a case. And he makes a mistake again.
No, I'm sorry. What they're talking about here is where there's some kind of scandal related to him. When we say goes bad, we don't mean that he judged a case and made a mistake. No. What we mean is, word on the street is, something fishy is going on with him. We don't have witnesses. We don't have an ability to actually try him. But we say to him, we'd rather that you not be judging cases. And in the event that new allegations arise, then we have to take it further. That's the idea.
No, sir, those other points. Sorry,
okay.
It means a personal sin or something.
Correct.
Unrelated to them.
Correct. If you like, I can give you a newspaper and you can take your pick from whatever's there that day. But yes, and the same thing is brought in by Maimonides regarding concern for parties of the court who are themselves unfit. He talks about here a case in which somebody is appointed to be a judge and he is unworthy of the position. And in such a case, as he puts it, it's like consecrating a blemished animal as a carbon, meaning inappropriate animal as a sacrifice. And he says, you can't do that. You can't have such people serve in a position which is supposed to have the public trust. So you see parallels between the systems. You have the concern for the public trust. That is found in both situations. You have the duty to the other lawyer and the opposing litigant. You're not allowed, even though it's adversarial, you're not allowed to do things that will cause the other side to make a mistake. And then in Judaism, you have an added element, which is litigation as a religious pursuit. And frankly, on the secular side, we have the added concern of relations between lawyers in general, as well as relations between lawyers in this particular case, and the need to make sure that you're going to preserve a working and workable relationship. So, with all of this in mind, let's come back now to our cases. How do you deal with this on a practical level? So, the challenge is what you see here in source number 18. How do you pronounce the name of this legal dictionary? And actually, I never actually asked anybody. Duhaim? Duhaim? Duhaim. Milaram. Okay. Duhaim. Okay. Duhaim's legal dictionary. Besides the duty, I've used it a bunch of times, but I never knew the name. Besides the duty which a lawyer owes to the court and his client, she or he is bound to treat the opposite party and fellow lawyers with civility, fairness, and propriety. Failing to do so is sharp practice. Obviously, from the above, it is challenging to pin down a definition of sharp practice, as it is subject to both a wide and a more limited definition by those law societies, and they are legion, that prohibit sharp practice. In other words, in different areas, geographic areas, in different communities, you're going to find different definitions, some more narrow, some more broad. In Canada, the more limited definition is favored, aimed more at taking unfair advantage of slips, irregularities, or mistakes on the part of the other side, including other lawyers, and they quote you an 1889 case in which the Ontario High Court wrote, to build up a client's case on slips of an opponent is not the duty of a professional man. Presumably it wouldn't say man if this had been written later than 1889. But the point is that it is difficult to pin down what is and is not sharp practice and where the lines should be drawn. So I'd like to work with some cases which I have found which may help to clarify where it is sharp practice and where it is not. So you go back to our initial case, which was the case of failure to warn, right? It was vignette number one that we saw on the first sheet. Failure to warn before noting in default. And in fact, that in that case, the ruling was that this was considered sharp practice, or really the term the judge used was that it was considered unprofessional. That was the language. If you take a look at source number 19, Garten v. Crook, which is not the name you want when you go into court. But anyway, Garten v. Crook. Should the actions of the plaintiff in failing to warn the defendant of an intention to note her in default provide grounds by itself to set aside the noting in default? In other words, will the penalty here for this sharp practice be that the default is disregarded? The defendant was in default in delivering a statement of defense. The plaintiff had a clear legal right to note her in default under Rule 19.01. Fine. Although a plaintiff may have a legal right to note default, it was unprofessional to do so without warning, particularly where the plaintiff was aware of the identity of the defendant's solicitor. Nothing is stopping you from actually sending correspondence. Nonetheless, a failure to warn without more does not provide grounds to set aside any resulting default judgment. Therefore, in my view, the failure to warn, although unprofessional, does not provide grounds by itself to set aside the noting of default, and may, however, be a factor in determining costs. Which is, I want to come back to costs. But the basic issue is error by opposing counsel. It's, you know, again, not going to the merits of the case. You're not allowed to take advantage of that. That's considered to be unprofessional, even if it won't result in a reversal. A popular example of this is in source number 20, coming from BC, but still applicable, I think, in Ontario as well. In negotiations between two lawyers with respect to a transaction, lawyer A receives from lawyer B draft 5 of the agreement between the clients. A clause that lawyer B emphasized was very important to her client in a previous draft is missing from the latest draft and does not seem to be covered by other parts of the agreement. Lawyer A chooses not to say anything and just to proceed without noting, hey, you lost something that actually mattered to you. And that's considered to be sharp practice. You know full well they wanted it to be there. It isn't as though they changed their mind and decided to, you know, just, you know, shorten the document. So yeah, you're not able to take advantage of that. And in fact, that's going to come up shortly in a particular case that I'm going to cite. It's not, yes.
Where does client instruction play a role? For instance, in the case of Logan Paul, you call your client, you know, after the time frame has passed, and you say, I haven't committed the defense yet. What are your instructions? So let's say, don't do the fall. Is sharp practice acting only in terms of, like, being a lawyer without instructing your client directly? Because sometimes, you know, certain procedural things, you don't check with your client every single time. You're following the rules. Or if your client in that case would also draft 5, if you told your client, hey, they didn't put this in,
yeah,
your client would say, let's sign now.
Right.
So,
but I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but the fact that the client advises that doesn't mean that that's the way you proceed. In other words, there is a routine to how this is done. Noting in default, the routine includes letting them know, you know, I'm going to note you in default. Your client says to you, if I don't notify them, then we can get them in default now. Isn't your response, yeah, but that's not the way this works?
Yes, but the judge is saying that that is the way this works. It might be a cost question, but that's not enough to overturn it. Your client might say, let's take advantage of it and pay the consequence at the end of the day. Well, what do you do in such a situation? You get off the record on something like that?
If you're going to view, and here, I have to admit, I haven't seen this written up directly, and therefore I'm going to ask the lawyers here to comment on this, but based on everything I've read, your duty to the court actually precedes your duty to the client. And if this is considered an offense to the court, then your responsibility to the client is to say, that's not professional, I can't do that. That would be my gut, but please, what do you...
It's also a duty to the client, because it's open and shut, that's going to be set aside.
Well, in this case, that wasn't grounds for setting aside. In this case, that wasn't grounds for setting it aside.
Which one?
In number 19. Does not provide grounds to set aside any resulting default judgment. It's a very interesting case because there are more nuances. Because after they did send the letter, the opposing litigant, the woman who didn't want to sell her house, went something like 15 months or something before responding.
But there are cases that go the other way. And
yes.
I personally had judgments set aside on the basis of failing to warn, not failing to warn,
mm-hmm.
or failing to warn.
Failing to warn, yeah. Yeah, I
would be shocked if, in these circumstances, currently a judgment would be set aside.
Mm-hmm. So that's consistent with what I've seen. I mean, you're making the practical argument, and I think it's correct. But I think also just
it's not just a practical argument because you're not serving your client's interests by letting him give you bad instructions that are going to result in an unsuccessful outcome
right. That
wastes his money and the other side's money and will result in
right.
like a negative outcome.
Right. There were a couple other hands on this. Yeah.
So I'm going to say I'm guilty of this. It wasn't a sharp practice. There was one insurance company that refused to provide defense on a timely basis for many years. It was chronic. And I brought 3 motions on the insurance company to enforce default. And I knew that it would get set aside. However, got set aside with a heavy penalty against the insurance company. And it didn't happen to me again. At least it may have happened to other people at other law firms. But also these days, there's something called cost insurance. So you're not giving a client bad advice to take a practical move like this because there's an insurance policy that pays the adverse cost of taking this advice.
Interesting. I mean, I would still make the argument of duty to the court. Even if you're insulated against the practical consequences of the action, it's reminiscent of this debate within Judaism, you know, where Jewish law says that, you know, you damage someone else's property, you have to pay for it. But there's a debate as to how we look at that. Is the fact that you have to pay for it essentially you're buying their property, or is it actually you did something wrong and this is a penalty to you for doing it wrong? If I look at it as you're buying their property, well, maybe this is worth it to me. And I can damage their property, and alright, you break it, you bought it, and that's the way it goes. That's what it sounds like, you know, in this case. It may be considered unprofessional, but if I'm insulated against it and this will actually redound to the benefit of my client, then maybe I go that route. But I think the duty of the court matters on this. Yeah?
It's a very factual analysis. In one case of rushing to the court on day 21 to note someone in default, you're going to run into problems. On the other hand, if it's 14 months after the fact, you note them in default because they've done nothing in radio silence, and another period of time goes by, it's much more likely to be upheld. Where you have recidivist breaches from the same insurance company, again, the court's much more likely to have it upheld.
Mm-hmm. Although, my answer would be, well, then why not just send them a letter, and that way you're covered. You know, you notify them. The insurance company throws out letters all the time. Oh, so if you did that, then there's no allegation. Then it's not. That's not. Look, if you notify, then you've satisfied your duty. I think that's pretty clear. So the issue of sharp practice is not only where the other lawyer made the mistake. It also applies where the mistake happens via a third party. So I gave an example in number 21, dealing with an error by a registrar, in which there's a will, but there is an objection to the will. And the way this works is that the party who objects is supposed to file a caveat or a notice of objection. I think there are different words used that I've seen in different places. But they file this caveat with a registrar in a particular municipality, and then that's supposed to circulate to all the other relevant registrars. But in this case, the registrar didn't circulate it. The other party, the one who wants to have the will executed, goes someplace where they don't know anything about the caveat and files to get it to proceed. So number 21, when a caveat has been filed in one Supreme Court registry but not in others through inadvertence, it is sharp practice for a lawyer to apply for letters of administration without notifying the lawyer who filed the caveat of the proposed application. Now, I should know, because I was told by a trust and estates lawyer, that this case actually can't happen, at least in Ontario, because the lawyer who's filing for the estate to actually be administered, for everything to be taken care of, it doesn't know about the caveat. In other words, the caveat, they're not notified. The caveat is filed without their knowledge. If so, that doesn't become so relevant. But I bring it because it shows that even where the error is not from the lawyer, the error is from some third party, like the registrar, it's considered sharp practice to take advantage. And then there's this case, number 22. I thought this was an interesting one. This involves an error by a tribunal. And in the first part of 22, I gave the background on this. The Ontario Labour Relations Board originally approved the following voting constituency as a bargaining unit: all journeymen and apprentice, refrigeration and air conditioning mechanics, journeymen and apprentice plumbers and pipe fitters, journeymen and apprentice sheet metal workers, journeymen and apprentice electricians, and the employee of Faringer Mechanical Limited in all sectors of the construction industry, ... All of them constitute a voting all of them constitute a bargaining unit. That's your setup. Now, the applicant acknowledges that it agreed in the certification process to exclude journeymen and apprentice plumbers and pipe fitters. It said that they had agreed to actually leave them out, and now they say, we've actually changed our mind, and we want them in. In other words, the original deal should not have included those words. The words journeymen and apprentice plumbers and pipe fitters didn't belong. The other party didn't want them. Everybody had agreed that they wouldn't be in. The tribunal made a mistake when they gave the wording and included the words. So now the applicant says, actually, we don't want those words excluded. We would like to have them, we originally agreed, you're right, but we want to have them in. We don't want anyone taking them out. So the board is generally reluctant to allow parties to change a position once this has formed the basis of an agreement between the party, but agreement by the parties. That's number one. You already agreed to it. And then the next line, the board would also point out, it is generally considered to be sharp practice, if not unethical, for one party to take advantage of a clear oversight by the opposite party in a proceeding, and this rule applies with even greater force to an oversight made by the tribunal before which the parties appear. You're not getting away with saying, well, it's in the language and we decided that we like it there. That doesn't happen. Your agreement was to leave it out. It has to be left out. Not only that, but sharp practice may come with a penalty. We talked about the penalty of having the default thrown out, but it actually also may come with a requirement to pay costs for the other side. There are quite a few cases that relate to this. This happens to be one that I was shown in number 23. I should note, because one of the lawyers here actually happens to be a person within the community, which I didn't know at the time that I used this example. I generally avoid that. But someone who saw the source sheet contacted me and mentioned that and said, there's no way this person would have done anything wrong. And so I'm just telling you, don't accept anything from what you see here. This is only an excerpt from a much longer piece, and I don't want it to reflect poorly on someone.
Also, it was set aside.
It was set aside. Yeah. You know the case, or you?
Yeah.
Okay.
He got leave to appeal, and Justice Morgan was very critical of Master Dash's decision.
Okay. Interesting. Okay, so it was set aside. Also worth noting, I generally speaking try to avoid any cases that involve anybody who someone might know, just as a matter of form. But nonetheless, the former counsel for the plaintiffs in this action seeks leave to appeal the order of Master Dash, dated October 30th, 2012, in which the learned master ordered him to personally pay $3,000. The central point in Master Dash's ruling is his finding, paragraph 21, that the party had engaged in sharp practice contrary to Rule 6.03.3. In coming to this conclusion, Master Dash relied on the divisional court's judgment in Garden v. Crook, the case that we saw before about the sale of the house. In that case, the defendant appealed a master's order refusing to set aside a noting in default, where plaintiff's counsel had not warned defendant's counsel he was about to do that. And Wilson indicated in one sentence, and as one of her reasons for reversing the master's order, that the master's refusal to grant relief to the defendant reinforces sharp practice. In other words, to there's a lot of spaghetti sort of going around and around here. But the idea is that if sharp practice is allowed to proceed without penalty, then effectively you reinforce it as a strategy. And therefore the argument is made by Master Dash, in the case that's referred to here, that it will be a good idea to actually require the one who's guilty of sharp practice to pay costs for the other side. That's the argument that Master Dash makes in this case. Whether that actually plays out or not, it did not play out that way in this particular case. It's worth being aware that that's a potential consequence of doing so. Having said that, you have the other side still, which is you have a duty to your client. There, you can't escape the responsibility to your client, and therefore, you can still benefit from opposing counsel's ignorance of relevant law. Meaning, the other side chose their lawyer. So in one case, the case that I'm thinking of, actually it's here, source number 24. Lawyer A states in a conversation with lawyer B that she will be issuing a writ against lawyer B's client well within the limitation period, which she states is 2 years. In fact, lawyer B knows the limitation period is shorter than that stated by lawyer A. But lawyer B has made no comment himself on what the limitation period is. That's an interesting question. You follow? Lawyer A and lawyer B. I've forgotten now who was A and who was B. But lawyer B said that they're going to file something and that they have 2 years to do it. Lawyer A knows they actually have 6 months to do it. Lawyer A never said you have 2 years. Is lawyer A able to just let lawyer B go about their business knowing that they're going to miss the deadline? According to this, that's not sharp practice. You're just being a good lawyer for your client.
Yeah. You negotiate agreements to cover 86 countries of the world.
Yes.
And because you wanted to exploit the invention in Japan, which has different rules than the United States, and the lawyer didn't know that, I'm not going to sit there and tell him what the law is in Japan. It's his responsibility.
Right. So I think in your case, it's easier. Because in your case, it's whether they're aware of what the law is in Japan. Here, it's a procedural matter, knowing what your deadlines are.
Well, I'll give you a better one. I was in Germany negotiating a deal, and the other side talked to each other in German. They mm-hmm. didn't ask me whether I spoke German.
Did you?
Yes. I had a good deal for my client.
Got it. Yes.
Yes. I apologize for being a smarty pants.
But?
So, Garden and Crook, the order that you have in here was set aside.
Yeah.
And the basis was, like, the critical passage from the appellate judgment was, the effect of the matter of the master's order reinforces what is sharp practice.
Right.
Which is a palpable and overriding error.
Right.
So the ultimate decision was that the sharp practice was sufficient to set aside the
Right. I mean, the concern there was, as I recall, that the master's order would have prevented the seller from being able to move forward. From being able to defend. I don't remember why. I just remember that was something that was there.
The appellate court fixed that too.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But the essential thing is that the sharp practice was sufficient
to cause the okay. You understand, though, in terms of the case that's in front of us, why I'm not sure that that actually is not sharp practice. Not notifying them when you know they're making a mistake about a deadline seems awfully close to some of the cases that we have called sharp practice. Yeah?
Well, part of it is because you're dealing with another lawyer who's expected to know the law.
Right.
It's a substantive issue, not a procedural one. If you were dealing with self-rep, the response would be you should check your limitation period and talk to a lawyer. You don't have to tell them what the limitation period is. It's not important to your client. Just alert them to the fact that there could be an issue and send them off to run the Google search and talk to a lawyer.
But why is a deadline substantive rather than procedural?
Not everybody knows the limitation period based on statute.
Exactly.
It
depends.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay, I wouldn't have known that. Okay, thank you. Yes?
I'm just wondering if your answer would change if the issue was the time period, the actual limitation period under the law, or if it was when the event occurred.
I don't understand.
So one would be the difference of the limitation period of, for example, 2 years.
Yeah.
The other would be...
In other words...
That the date of loss was one day, but you actually know that the date of loss was a different day.
Interesting.
I mean, it strikes me as though I think what was just said makes sense, that where it's just under the law, that would be something that would be sharp practice, whereas the knowledge of the fact...
Strikes
me as something that would be something that I would owe to my client, and that would be something that I would...
Right, I mean...
I'd be less likely to share that information.
A mistake on something fundamental like that, I mean, they may end up at law pro.
Not necessarily, if their client gave them some information.
Right, no, if the client gave them the wrong information, that's another story. Right, no, that's another story. From a Jewish law perspective, we also have, as we've seen, the opposition to sharp practice. And in fact, if you take a look at source number 7, you see a statement about somebody who loses in court in an honest way. Source number 25. One who leaves the court bereft of his cloak should sing as he walks. Meaning if you lose, but you lost honestly, you should be happy. And as the commentators to that explain, you don't want that which isn't yours. If it's not yours, then good. Because if you walked away with your coat inappropriately, that will be theft. So from a Jewish law perspective, you don't want to profit from sharp practice. And if you take a look at number 26, you find this expressed in terms of the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law. The case that we're dealing with is a case in which two witnesses are required to testify. You have somebody who says, I lent so-and-so money. I only have one witness. And the person I lent the money to knows I only have one witness. So therefore, they're not going to pay me back. So he says to you, do me a favor, come stand with my legitimate witness. You're not going to testify in court. I just want you to stand there to intimidate the other party, in that way, they're going to pay up. So Rabbi Moshe Isserles writes, one may not listen to someone who says, come stand beside my single witness without testifying, so that my debtor will be afraid, thinking I have two witnesses, and will admit the debt. You can't mislead the other party, even though you avoided saying anything. We don't go for that. Sorry? Then the debtor wins. Better for the debtor to win than for you to exercise this level of deception in order to win. I thought I had another case here. Let me just see if I put it somewhere else on the sheet, because there's one more case that's worth bringing. No, it's not on here. I have a case, but it's not on here. I should have brought it, but it's a case that goes the other direction. Let me see if I can reconstruct it. You know what? I'm not going to reconstruct it correctly, so I'm going to leave it out. It's okay. The case I was going to bring was a case in which Jewish law seems to sanction use of a trick of sorts to defeat the other side. And what I'll do is, in the follow-up email, I'll include the case that you'll get a chance to see, a case in which sharp practice seems to be endorsed, but it's to the substance rather than to a matter of procedure. This is also a good time to remind people to please make sure that you sign in for those who came late. Okay. The next phase of this is dealing with the self-represented litigant, and seeing that we've got 20 minutes to go, I think we can still fit it in, but I'm keeping my eye on the clock. We don't need to go home in more snow than we have to. So here we add a new complication when you're dealing with self-represented litigants, and that is the issue of access to justice. As far as the Canadian system is concerned, self-representation is not inappropriate, it's not bad, it's every person's right, and it's considered normal. And therefore, you don't want the self-represented party to suffer, and therefore, the professional rep is obligated to take steps to avoid taking advantage of the other. Still noting what we said from Heintzman back in... Which one was Heintzman? It was number 10, where he said, nonetheless, your duty is, after your duty to the court, after your duty to your professional regulating body, your duty is to your own client. We don't want you bending over backward to the point where you're harming your client in order to help the litigant on the other side. Nonetheless, there is a concern of making sure that there is justice for the self-represented party on the other side. In Judaism as well, you see such a value. The whole idea of a legal system, as far as Jewish law is concerned, is what's called in Hebrew, "Latzil Ashuk Miyad Oshko," to save the person who is vulnerable and being harmed from the person who is causing them harm. That's a basic requirement. I'm skipping number 27 in the interests of time and jumping to 28, where by Moses Maimonides formulates it. And he talks about the fact that in the biblical text, when they go looking for judges initially, certain character traits are mentioned. And one trait is that they should be anshei chayil, men of chayil. So Maimonides explains what that means. It means they must have a brave heart to save the abused from one who would abuse him. That's that phrase, Latzil Ashuk Miyad Oshko. They have to want to save the abused from one who would abuse him. And they give an example of this, Moses, at the well, when he saves the daughters of Yitro from the people who are harming them. That's considered to be the imperative of all involvement in the legal system from a Jewish perspective. A verse that gets quoted frequently in this regard is in source number 29, Psach Picha Le'ilim. Open your mouth on behalf of the mute. You're supposed to help other parties. So in source number 30, you find an example of that involving Rav, one of the leading sages of 3rd century Common Era, who was a judge in court in the case that's being described here. In Jewish law, every 7 years, loans that are in default are wiped out. That's a basic rule. Every 7 years, loans that are outstanding, already due for payment, are wiped out. However, going back to the times of the Mishnah, more than 2,000 years ago, there was a concern, which is, you will completely wipe out your credit system that way. No one's going to want to lend to anybody knowing that they might not be able to get paid back. And there's a biblical law that says, if somebody needs money, you're supposed to lend to them. So in your interest of preserving the system, you're causing people to violate the biblical law. And so the sages found a loophole. And the loophole is what's called prosbul. Prosbul essentially takes advantage of the following rule. Personal loans, a loan from me to somebody else, if that person hasn't paid me back and they were supposed to pay me back before the 7th year, then that loan is wiped out. However, if a loan is turned over to a rabbinical court for collection, then it has a different status. It's now the court's. It's a debt owed to the court. And therefore, that does not get wiped out. And so what they did was, they came up with a document called a prosbul. And they said, we are going to mass produce this. Anybody who has loans outstanding to other individuals, just fill out this document before the end of the 7th year, And the document says, I'm assigning this to the rabbinical court for collection, and that's good enough. That's the Prosbul document. So Rav is one of the sages in the 3rd century, and he is a judge on a court, and a litigant comes to him saying, so-and-so owes me money. And the fellow on the other side says, it's too late, the 7th year passed. This loan is no longer in effect. And the lender is looking at him like, oh no, what do I do? He's dumbfounded. So Rav says, I'm going to help him out. I'm going to ask him a question. Maybe you had a Prosbul and it was simply lost. And he says, asking that question is within the purview of opening your mouth for the mute. This is a person who really needs legal advice. He doesn't have it. Even though he's the judge, talking about bending over backwards to help the self-represented litigant, he says, it's fair game for me to offer him this advice. Another example in source number 31 of another sage doing the same. And in fact, Maimonides records this as practical procedure. Take a look at number 32, please. Maimonides' advice for conduct in court. He says, how do we know that a judge should not act as an interpreter for the litigant's words? How do you know you're not supposed to argue on behalf of the litigant? Remember, they don't have a lawyer as a formal position. But the judge shouldn't do it. Distance yourself from falsehood, the Bible says. Rather, he should say what appears to him and be silent. He should not teach either litigant any claim. Even if a litigant brings just one witness, he shouldn't say, we don't accept one witness. Rather, he should say to the defendant, this one has testified against you. He should say, this party has testified against you. Don't make the argument that he could make up, but it's only one witness. Leave it to him to say so. If only the other would admit and say, he testifies honestly, because maybe when one witness says his testimony, maybe the party who's being testified against will acknowledge it. Until a defendant says, he's just one witness, he's not credible to me. And so in all similar cases. But then he says, if the judge sees merit for one party, and that litigant tries to make the point, but doesn't know how to put it together, or the judge sees the litigant is taking pains to save himself with an honest point, but it escapes him because of his rage and anger, or he is confused because of his foolishness, then he may assist the litigant a little to explain the beginning of it under this principle of open your mouth for the mute. You can do a little bit. One must be very careful with this, lest he be as those who arrange the judges. You don't want to go too far. But what I'm trying to show you with these sources is that there is a concern for the status of the vulnerable in court. And there's an attempt to try to create an even playing field. So go back now to vignette number 2, right? The case of James, who sued the pharmaceutical company and lost. He's representing himself in an appeal. And lead counsel for the pharmaceutical company, Mary, sees that James is having difficulty meeting the deadline. Doesn't seem to be aware. He can request an extension. Does Mary have to inform James that he can get an extension? What would you say? No. Anyone say yes? Everyone says, let the self-represented fellow hang. You do not need to tell him. So the truth is, one approach is to say, I don't have any duty to him. I'm not allowed to harm him. But in this case, he's doing it to himself. This is not, courtesy. I'm plenty courteous. I am, acceding to requests for information. But I don't have to give him anything. Yeah.
Lynn. I was going to make the point that not all self-represented are equal. Some are genuinely vulnerable and need the assistance. And some are self-represented because they can't get along with lawyers. They don't want to listen to anyone. And I think that factual analysis has to be taken into account.
That's a good point. Right, it's a valid consideration. Why is this person self-representing? How did they get here, effectively? Although I would note that even the person who is self-representing because of difficulty getting along with the lawyers, there may be some level of disability or something going on that's creating that. In other words, that doesn't make them automatically deserving of whatever happens to them. There has to be something deeper than this person is in this position because they're trying to save their money to be able to send their kid to college, and this person is doing it because they hate legal advice. So the argument of the Advocate Society in number 33 is advocates must not attempt to gain a benefit for their clients solely due to the fact that a litigant is self-represented. Counsel should cooperate with the court in ensuring that a self-represented litigant receives a fair hearing. So far, so good. You're not preventing them from having a fair hearing. At trial, advocates are entitled to raise proper and legitimate objections, but should not take advantage of technical deficiencies in the self-represented litigant's case. But again, you're not really taking advantage. It's them doing this to themselves without you actually doing anything. And indeed, I brought you a case in number 34. Counsel are not required to assist parties opposite on matters of substance, nor do they need to make or even to ensure that the parties opposite understand the strategic choices that might be available to them. They're required to assist on scheduling and similar matters to ensure the other side has an opportunity to present his or her evidence fairly. But it would seem that there's no obligation for you to give the information about filing for an extension. Having said that, there may be two practical reasons for you to inform them. Number one, you run the risk otherwise that when they appeal and say, I didn't realize that I could have filed for an extension, that's going to be accepted, and then litigation is going to drag on. In other words, the judge may say, yeah, they didn't know any better and feel bad. That's number one. Number two, the judge may also appreciate your sensitivity and be more favorably disposed to your clients because, look at that, they went out of their way to help. So there may be some practical benefits to doing so. Interestingly, from a Jewish law perspective, you may come back to the distinction that Gwendolyn noted, meaning why are they self-represented? Where the self-represented party could have retained counsel, we actually look at differently from where they could not have retained counsel. If you take a look at source number 35, a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch on the Code of Jewish Law. This is a comment from the Sma, the Sefer Yirat Einayim. It's a commentary on the Code of Jewish Law, where he talks about the existence of asymmetric legal representation and says, today's practice of judging lo azim, Loazim means those who don't speak Hebrew generally, via their assignee, via the person who's speaking on their behalf, who they assign to represent them, is because all who come for judgment before permanent judges today are as though they had accepted this type of judgment. There's nothing to do after that acceptance. In other words, what he's saying is, in our courts that he's familiar with, in Poland of 300, 400 years ago, we have situations in which one party in a case may have a representative, Morshe, as they're called in the Hebrew, and the other party does not have a representative. Why are we good with that? He says we're good with that because that's the way it's done and everybody accepts that this is okay. We accept asymmetrical legal representation because this is the way that everybody functions and everybody seems to be fine with it. Implying that where the party is not fine with it, we wouldn't be okay with it. Where the party who's not represented says, I'm unhappy about the fact that they've got a legal expert on the other side, then we're going to say, you know what? This isn't fair. We need to do something about it. We're not going to proceed with an asymmetrical system. In fact, there are those who have written contemporarily within rabbinical courts about not wanting representatives for one side if the other side cannot have a rep as well. So if you have a situation in which the self-represented person simply couldn't afford counsel in a Jewish court, they may look more favorably at the idea of requiring help for this party who is not represented in order to level the playing field. There will be more sympathy for the self-represented party who couldn't have done otherwise. So that's our second case. Quickly to cover the last case. Our last case. And the last case was, is a lawyer entitled to use sharp practice if it's in order to help a client who the lawyer believes is indeed correct? Is there any side to say, well, in that case, you're justified in doing so? So I can't find anything within the secular legal system that says that this is a good idea. Yes, you may think your client is right, but no, that's not, at least what I've seen. I've never seen that as grounds for doing so. Has anyone seen anything that would justify it?
Well, you presuppose you said it's sharp practice.
Right. You're not supposed to engage in sharp practice, correct. In Jewish law, however, we do have some precedent to support the idea of actually doing so. The Code of Jewish Law talks about somebody who delays repayment of a debt in order to get a creditor to agree to settle. Generally speaking, in Jewish law, you're not allowed to do that, right? You owe somebody $10,000, and you drag out repayment, figuring he's going to get so frustrated that if I tell him I'll pay him $7,500 now, he'll forgive me the other $2,500. That's not okay. That's not something you'd be allowed to do. However, take a look at source number 36. So, Yaakov Lorbebaum of Lisa, also known as the Nesivos, he says, if one knows that the truth is with him, but the court won't trust him. He says, I actually am right. He doesn't have a $10,000 claim against me, but I can't prove it to the court. Then he may seek ways to instigate a compromise. He must only avoid acting as a wicked person before the court. He can't go too far, but he may be able to take advantage of methods such as the foot dragging in order to get himself a better result. We find a passage in the Talmud that justifies, in number 37, lying to a thief in order to avoid having something taken. That's not a litigation case, so that's probably not the best example. I brought you in number 38 an example that is in a litigation scenario. Rabbi Moshe Sofer, also known as the Chasam Sofer, talks about the possibility of being a participant in a set of witnesses. There are two witnesses. You are one witness. There's another witness. Knowing that the witness you are testifying alongside is technically disqualified as a witness, but you know your testimony is true. So by you testifying in court, you're going to cause this other party's testimony to be accepted. And he says, if you know your testimony is true, then you would be allowed to testify alongside the other party. So I wonder if there isn't justification for some level of sharp practice in order to help the good guy win, so to speak. I'm not sure, because you can also bring sources opposing it. In number 39, you find Maimonides' comments when the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot teaches that a judge is not allowed to act as the Orchei HaDayanim. A judge is not allowed to act as a lawyer for one of the parties in a case. Maimonides writes in source number 39, even where one knows that this party has been cheated, the vulnerable party has been cheated, and that the opposing litigant is lying, one may in no way teach him claims that will assist him. The judge is not allowed to go too far in helping. So you can find sources in Jewish law that seem to sympathize where the party actually is right and is just not succeeding on the merits, trying to say, let's find some other way. But because you find sources on both sides, I'm loath to actually say that Jewish law recommends this. I think it's not so clear-cut in terms of what one could or couldn't do. But from a secular perspective, in the secular legal system, I have not found a justification. Okay, so to do a very fast summary of what we said. Number one, we showed that within the Law Society of Ontario system, the lawyer as advocate is required to treat the tribunal with candor, courtesy, respect, and so on, to maintain civility, and also in the relationship with other lawyers. You have to act in good faith, avoid sharp practice, don't take advantage of mistakes not going to the merits. And we said that the major reasons for this are, in part, pragmatic, general trust among lawyers, as well as issues are going to come up in this case which require the lawyers to work together, including potentially settlement. We also noted the overall duty to the state, the duty to the court, the duty to the legal system, and the concern about the reputation of the legal system and the reputation of lawyers within the community. We noted that there are parallels to this in Judaism, but Judaism has an added factor against sharp practice, which is that litigation is considered a religious pursuit. Pursuing justice is a religious pursuit, and you're not entitled to cheapen that and deconsecrate it by saying, I just want to win, and I'm going to use some means to achieve that, which isn't consistent with justice. So we went back to our case, the not notifying before noting someone in default. We said that was considered unprofessional. It was labeled sharp practice. We noted the potential for the overturning of, the reversal of the default in such a case. We even noted that sharp practice may be punished with costs. We also noted that it isn't only about the error of the opposing lawyer. It could also be about the error by the tribunal, error by a registrar, taking advantage of any of that. On the other hand, we noted that if it's a matter of substance, then the lawyer is justified in taking advantage of that error. From a Jewish law perspective as well, we said you don't want to win if you're not entitled to it. That would constitute theft. Using sharp practice to cause an error would indeed be wrong within Judaism, even though there is the case, which I want to send out by email afterward, in which we find one of the sages indeed advising somebody to do what seems a little bit like sharp practice in order to win a case, where there was a party who was vulnerable. We talked about the added obligation for the self-represented litigant, where there's a concern for access to justice. We noted that you find in Judaism as well the concern about taking care of the vulnerable. However, we said that, again, this doesn't mean that you harm your client, and therefore you don't have to tell them about the ability to file for an extension, although practically that may be beneficial, either because you're helping your client by taking the long view and helping out in the procedural matter, and I have to thank Jeffrey Silver for that insight, as well as the judge may appreciate your sensitivity. In the Jewish system, if they could have retained counsel, we have less sympathy. But if they really couldn't have retained counsel, then indeed we may be more sympathetic because they didn't agree to asymmetrical representation in court. Finally, helping a victim get his due. In the secular system, I can't find grounds for it. From a Jewish law perspective, I think the sources are mixed and it's less clear. And as I said in the very beginning, for a practical matter, please make sure to check with your rabbi. It's certainly not meant as either legal advice or halachic advice. Again, if you did not sign in, please make sure to do so. Thank you very much. Have a safe drive home.